Okay, it's October the 29th, 2007. Hugh Gordon interviewing Tom Hamill, H-A-M-A-L-L. If you will, start off with where you were born and raised and the culture that you lived with at that time. I think you have some early recollections of that.
I'll be happy to do that. Born in Evanston, Illinois. Lived in the north end of Chicago in an Irish Catholic ghetto. When I was 9 years old, my family, my mother and I at that point, moved to join my grandparents in Miami, Florida. And that's when I first recognized that there were true differences. Not only was I a Yankee, I was born in Chicago, and I was a Catholic. Well, for those three reasons, I took a lot of verbal and some physical abuse for a period of some months when I was 9 years old in 1942. Also, I learned a few other things about the differences in race, because my mother and I used to travel at least once a week on a bus down 79th Street across the causeway to Miami Beach and go to 71st Street Beach. We often stayed until late afternoon, and back in those days, if you were a black woman and you were a housekeeper, you had to be off the beach by 7 o'clock at night, by dusk, or have special permission. So one particular day we were getting on the bus quite late, and there were a number of black women carrying their shopping bags coming on board the bus, and the bus was very full. And of course in those days there was a white line literally on the floor of the bus, and the blacks were not able to sit in front of that line. And if there were more whites on board, the whites could continue to move all the way on back and the blacks would have to stand. Well, this one day we were sitting right at the line, and my mother and I, and this one very elderly, very frail black woman came on board the bus, and all the seats were taken. And my mother and I both got up and gave her a seat. Well, the bus driver stopped.
Okay.
And gave my mother a terribly rough time. And with that, my mother said, "Open the doors, I'm getting out." So at the next stop, we did get out and we waited for the next bus. That was really my very first.
And you were how old then?
I was 10.
10 years old.
Yep. That was really my very first exposure to racism.
Let's stop for. Okay, now we're going. All right, let's go further along in your.
I guess you could say, in many respects, because I was born into an Irish Catholic family, and back in those days, when you were in Chicago, you lived in an Irish Catholic neighborhood, a Polish Catholic neighborhood, or an Italian Catholic neighborhood. And they all met, but there was very little interaction. We all had our own churches and we had our own schools.
Mm-hmm.
At age 9, we moved to Miami, and that was right at the beginning of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a Catholic school there, too. And back in those days, there were no African Americans, or for that matter, very few Hispanics in the area. So I went to a lily white school. But I saw at a distance racism, but I really didn't see any overt signs of it, except when I went in the Navy. I did see a lot of signs, and you have to recognize that back in the 1930s and early 1940s, Florida was a very different place. It was not a cosmopolitan area. It had snowbirds coming in for the winter months.
Yeah.
But there was nothing for people to do, no work, mm-hmm. other than in the hotels and climbing poles for the power company and the telephone company, or delivering milk. We still had milk delivery back in those days. But there weren't many really solid jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So the real growth didn't come among both the black and the white population until after the war.
Okay.
But I did, at the end of my high school career, I graduated at 17. The summer prior to my graduation, when I was 16, I convinced my mother that she should sign papers saying that I was 17, and I joined the Navy Reserve. And
okay.
I spent the summer between my junior and senior year in high school at the U.S. Naval Air Station in Opa-locka, Florida, doing a full 6-week boot camp.
Okay.
Quite an experience.
Was that integrated or segregated?
It was totally segregated.
Okay.
Absolutely. The only African Americans that I ever saw on that base
mm-hmm.
were cooks
mm-hmm.
and cleaning crew, maintenance
right.
crew.
Mm-hmm.
But there were no mechanics,
yep.
No office workers,
mm-hmm.
None.
Yep.
Certainly no officers.
Tom, let's move into the civil rights era. Our history project is about the 50s, 60s, and the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Can do that very
so
readily.
So you've given me a good background on the segregation culture that you grew up in.
Very fine.
And but the civil rights era was a different era. It was a breakthrough era.
It was a totally different era. And I can have my first recalls of that when I got out of the service, and I went to work in Miami, jobs being hard to find, I went to work for North American Loan and Thrift, and I was given the marvelous title of loan closer collector. Well, 90% of the loans made were made to African Americans.
Okay.
90% of the loans that were made went 90 and 120 days delinquent.
Okay.
And the company really didn't mind that, because in that way, the people were always in your debt.
Yeah.
And all you were doing was collecting the high rate of interest.
So
I had my first exposure to a full black community by going into Liberty City
okay.
to do my collections.
Uh-huh. Did they sell insurance too?
We didn't sell uh-huh. insurance. We just sold money at a premium rate.
I'm familiar with industrial life insurance to blacks. It's really just to get them buried.
Yes.
With $500 policies.
Right. Well, this was maximum
was
loans
Virginia.
Of $300.
Yeah.
And they were to pay it back at the rate of 20 some odd dollars a month.
Okay.
But the fact of the matter is, most of them ended up paying $30 and $40 a month in interest and
okay.
never getting anything off of the principal or very little. So I bring that up because
yeah.
that has some real impact in terms of the kinds of experiences I had later in life
okay.
into the 60s
okay.
and into the 70s.
Let's move up to 1950. Where were you in 1950?
Right. Well, 1950, I was in the Navy.
Okay. And then, when you...
In 1919, early 1950s, I was with North American Loan and Thrift.
Okay.
And I left them. I was a student full-time at the University of Miami, but also working full-time.
Okay.
And I was fortunate enough to be hired by the American Cancer Society.
Okay.
I was the first paid director of education
okay.
for the American
yeah.
Cancer Society mm-hmm. in Dade County,
did you,
Florida.
In your college education, did you stay there at the University of Miami?
I stayed at Miami until the Cancer Society transferred me to New York City
mm-hmm.
to the national office was then
okay.
located in New York on 57th Street, directly
okay.
across the street from CBS Studios.
Uh-huh.
And I then transferred up to Columbia. And so I was working as the program director for the medical and scientific department of the American Cancer Society at the
Columbia,
National
Ohio?
Office.
No,
Columbia, Columbia.
Columbia.
Columbia University.
Oh,
in
Columbia,
New York,
New York City. Sure.
Right, in New York City.
Uh-huh.
And actually, the American Cancer Society eventually named me a fellow in public health and administrative medicine.
Okay.
And paid the freight for me to go to Columbia. But my next real experience, I spent 10 years with the Cancer Society in Miami, in New York. Obviously, I saw a lot of racial tensions there, and then was transferred out to Omaha, Nebraska. I headed the first unit of the Cancer Society in Omaha, Nebraska back in 1957. And hardly ever even saw a black person.
Is that right?
Hardly ever.
Mm-hmm.
Then transferred to Union County, New Jersey, which is outside of Newark, and again began to see a major influx of African Americans into the community and a lot of basic racial tension. But my job was so focused, I really didn't have much of an opportunity to feel or sense that.
Mm-hmm.
From the Cancer Society, I went to the Mental Health Association for a short period of time, and then on to the Strand Clinic in New York City. And during those experiences, they were all wonderfully enlightening and marvelous growing experiences for me. But in essence, I was living in a white culture.
Okay.
After a few years with the Strand Clinic Preventive Medicine Institute as their director of development and public affairs, I was approached and accepted a job as the first director of development and public affairs for the New Jersey College of Medicine and Dentistry. We were located in Jersey City, New Jersey. We were taking over the operation of Seton Hall Medical School. The school had been founded more on faith than finance, and when the federal government began to pull away the support that they had given for research, the school went down the tubes.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a decision to make. We did not want to stay in Jersey City. We wanted to get out of Jersey City, and we wanted to be of service more broadly to mankind. We were offered over 25 sites across the state, and we finally winnowed it down to the Morris Estate in Morristown, and the Madison Estate in Morristown, and or Newark, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
We decided on Newark, and the reason we decided on Newark was because there were over 250,000 African Americans that were totally without medical care. Their physicians had left Newark to move and follow their more affluent patients to suburbia. And here are 250,000 people relying on a hospital, Martland Hospital, which had been dubbed the butcher shop on the hill, and rightly so.
Mm-hmm.
So we said we would go to Newark, and Hugh Adonisio, who was the mayor of Newark in those days, offered us 325 of the most densely populated, best politically organized black acres in the city of Newark.
Hmm.
Well, if you read the Kerner Commission report, you will quickly see that we were named as one of the causative factors for the riots in Newark, New Jersey in July of 1967, and rightly so. We were so naive. We just saw the opportunity to go in and be of service, but they saw us as coming in and destroying what political clout the community had. So Paul Ulvaeusacker, who was in charge of community affairs for Governor Hughes, led a negotiation team, and we negotiated with the black community and ultimately came down to 67 acres from the 325 we had originally been offered. We also offered to have at least a third of the construction jobs in the construction of our medical school and one third of the support jobs at the medical and dental college to be filled by African Americans. So that's where my first real experience in dealing with affirmative action came about, because we had to go out and seek and find African-American contractors, upgrade their skills through added training and through registration so that they could become eligible for state contracts, And then we also had to talk about training programs for all of the support jobs within the medical and dental college. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to say that we raised the first $100 million that was required to get the school off the ground, mm-hmm. and that we met our agreements. Mm-hmm. But in the course of doing that, we went through a riot. We also, at that point,
that was 1967,
mm-hmm. July of 67. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had half tracks and tanks on the premises of where we were going to build the mm-hmm. medical college.
What was the primary cause of that riot? You know,
it was.
Well, of course, it was all over the country.
It was all over the country, but basically, Hugh, that had been festering for over 20 years.
Yeah.
There had been a report done in 1947 that talked about the despicable condition of housing mm-hmm. in the city of Newark mm-hmm. and the lack of proper employment. There was 20 years of people living in a type of subjugation mm-hmm. and where they were treated not much better than cattle when it came to medical care.
Right.
People would line up in the morning before we took over the medical school and the hospital, would line up outside the clinics. And rather than giving out appointments, you might have 200 people lined up for well baby clinic or for sick baby care. Mm-hmm. And they would be there at 7:30 in the morning, the doors opening at 8. And then one of the staffers would come and count down the row the first 35 to 50 and then say, everybody else go home. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were treated despicably.
Yeah.
And I think that it was a combination. Mm-hmm. And when they wanted the medical school, they wanted us the worst way because they realized that one of their greatest needs mm-hmm. was in medical care, but they also recognized mm-hmm. that they were losing what little bit of political clout yeah. they had gained.
We have the statistics, part of our research is on the riots across the country, how many people were killed and the property damage and all of that. Watts, of course, and other cities has got all that data. Did you see the people, or did you watch, would you observe
The riots?
The riots.
Certainly did.
How would you describe it? Were they young people or what?
The vast majority were, I would say, under age 40. Mm-hmm. There were some exceptions to the rule.
Yeah.
But the vast majority were teens to 40s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's where I stand. Pretty much across the country.
Right. And of course, we had the riots not only yeah. in Newark, where I worked, but mm-hmm. also in Plainfield, where I lived.
Right.
Because we had moved from Madison Township, New Jersey, into Plainfield, which also had a riot mm-hmm. in July of 67, but because we saw the opportunity to have a much larger home, Plainfield had at one time been the summer capital for the bankers on Wall Street. They and their families would summer mm-hmm. in Plainfield because of mm-hmm. the elevation and the mm-hmm. and the coolness of the air, and then train into Manhattan mm-hmm. To the banks.
I've done a good bit of research on the Kerner Commission report, and which was a commission appointed by President Johnson to mm-hmm. investigate the riots and come up with some conclusions on how to deal with it. The truth of the matter is that it didn't help President Johnson much, and it's consequently the facts are that he did not pay respect to the people that on the commission like you normally would. You know, maybe invite them to the White House and things like that. He just sort of pushed it aside. But it did serve a purpose to him to realize, and this is where it's important to the history book I'm doing, that he had to look at not to the government, but to the private sector for the solution to the problem of economically disadvantaged people, blacks mostly. And that's when he called 15 businessmen to the White House I've got his talking points, everything from the Austin LBJ Library. I've got all of that stuff, the important part of the history. That was the beginning of a partnership between American business and government at the highest levels above.
That's very true. The fact of the matter is there was a lot going on at the state government levels prior to that. Mm-hmm. And for an example, Paul Ilvesacher, who later became a department head at Yale University, mm-hmm. but was in charge of community affairs for Governor Hughes, he really developed a very strong task force to deal with the issues of race in New Jersey. And if he hadn't done that, we never would have been able to move forward and build a medical school that now is not just a medical and a dental school, but has four campuses across the state of New Jersey. But that was done as a joint venture too, because we had Orville Beale, who was the chairman of the board of Prudential, and George Smith, who was the chairman of the board of Johnson & Johnson, as the co-chairman of our board at the medical college.
Yeah.
So it was a truly a joint venture. We never could have done it without that.
Right. I do that. There we go. Let's, if you will, Tom, let's talk about your private sector experience with Borden.
Okay. There is a very natural bridge. When I was with the medical college, we were preparing our grant to the federal government, to HEW, for our major construction grant. And I hired as a consultant to me a fellow by the name of Carlton Spitzer, who had been the in charge of all information programming for HEW under John Gardner. And he worked with me and we strategized and we gained what was then the largest grant ever given to a medical college for the construction of our facility in Newark. But he left and went to work for Borden and became vice president of public affairs for the Borden Company. And he and Gus Marusi asked me if I would be willing to work with them on some key issues that they were experiencing in the area of race relations. Because of my experience through the medical college in dealing with significant race issues in Newark. And we've only touched on that, but it was, there's a whole book involved in those years.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, I thought about it and I finally agreed to go to work with Borden. But they said, before you come to work for Borden, we would like you to work directly with the White House. And I said, how am I going to do that? They said, well, Gus Marusi, who is our board chairman, has been asked to chair the White House Conference on Children and Youth in 1970-1971. Mm-hmm. And they need, Congress in its wisdom had allocated $1 million for a $3 to $4 million conference.
Okay.
So you know what my assignment was, to raise the difference to make the conference possible.
Right.
When I got to Borden after the year in and out of Washington, they said, Tom, we want you to do three things for the company. First, we would like you to head the Minority Affairs Council. Second, we would like you to become president of our foundation. And third, we need a Smokey the Bear to deal with all local government issues. So we want you to be corporate director of civic affairs. Well, I said yes. And I guess...
Where was Borden located?
At that point, we were located on... Well, we had offices both on Madison Avenue and on Park Avenue in New York. But shortly after my accepting the position, Gus decided to move everything but the executive office to Columbus, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So, very shortly thereafter, I wasn't commuting into New York City any longer. I was on board a plane and flying to Columbus, Ohio as a part of the lead guard to deal with the transfer of several thousand jobs.
Tell me about Borden a little bit.
Borden, at that juncture, it's now been greatly diffused. It's been bought out. It's no longer the company that it was.
Mm-hmm.
But we were, in 1970, We were a $4 billion, 46,000 employee company with facilities in 23 countries, manufacturing facilities in 23 countries. People think of Borden as being milk and dairy products, but we were also Jean Patou Joy perfume back in those days at 50 some odd dollars an ounce.
Mm-hmm.
Peanut butter, jellies, potato chips, popcorn.
My wife could probably tell. She's a big shopper. She's probably
But it was a very, very diverse and very large in chemicals. Yeah. It's then the number one producer of a number of key chemicals.
Does Borden exist today under the name of Borden?
No.
What is it?
It does not. It has been bought out and sold out. It's no longer a company,
mm-hmm.
In the strict sense of the word. They still have used the Borden label, but I don't know who owns Borden ice cream anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether Borden milk is even sold anywhere mm-hmm. in the United States.
Okay.
It's amazing what time will bring. But during those years, one of the first things that we did was deal with one of the issues that the PIC was very much concerned with.
Right.
We did an initial study to take a look at how were we really dealing with the minority community,
mm-hmm.
and what jobs were we really creating and how were we doing it, and what was our purchasing looking like in relationship to minority firms. And Carl Spitzer and I did a report, brought it to Gus Marussi, and said, Gus, at this point we have some $230 million in annual sales that are in jeopardy because we're not meeting affirmative action guidelines set forth by the federal government for contractors and subcontractors.
Borden, there was a federal contractor.
Oh yes, primarily through the ship stores and the mm-hmm. and the mm-hmm. commissaries, mm-hmm. what have you, all the food products.
That's Executive Order 10925.
Right, exactly. So when Gus heard that, he said, well, damn it, we'd better do something about that. And we said, Gus, writing memos isn't going to hack it.
Not going to do it.
We had better come up with some better ways. So after considerable thought, turmoil, and discussion, we decided that we needed to treat affirmative action in exactly the same way as we treated all other issues of production. And we needed to tie it directly to the incentive pay package of all of our executives who were in charge profit centers.
You were looking at them to see if they included particularly minorities and blacks, sure.
Right.
So sort of, it wasn't a quota, but you rewarded them for doing the right thing.
We rewarded them for doing the right thing, and mm-hmm. we actually tied in most all of the. Well, you know, we had so many sub profit centers,
uh-huh.
In the food division, in the chemical division,
right.
in the dairy division, that what we did is we said, okay, 25% of your bonus income. Profit center manager is going to be directly tied to minority hiring, minority upgrade, and minority purchasing.
Do they set goals that were?
Oh yes.
And so they had to perform against their goals.
They had to perform
against
their goals.
That's the same thing that we had in Lockheed. Management, MICP, Management Incentive Compensation Program. And my salary administrator administered it for Lockheed, but we identified goals going beyond race, but in my case, the staffing, the programs, the billion-dollar programs. I'm going to do this.
Right.
I'm going to reduce our backlog of charges of discrimination, and we're going to
mm-hmm.
Represent ourselves in lawsuits of race discrimination. All measurable.
Precisely.
My compensation was based on that.
It was amazing, you know, that some of our profit center managers who said, gee, I can't find a manager, an African American. There aren't any out there. Well, it was amazing once we hit them in the pocketbook, how well they could perform. So
they got more creative. Right?
They got much more creative, and to try and help them through that process, we did a variety of things, along with Standard Oil of Indiana. Uh-huh. Borden co-founded the National Minority Supplier Development Council.
Let me insert this question to you. It always comes up. To what degree is this voluntary, and to what degree is it to defend yourself against contract compliance regulations?
50-50 at best. 50-50. At best. Mm-hmm. I think with some of us at the working staff level, the motivation may have been more 75 in favor of doing the right thing. But I think when you got into the upper echelons, it was at best 50-50.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you work down the line, though, the implementation of all your affirmative action policies was dependent upon people at the lowest level performing.
That's right.
Because they do the most of hiring, make
That's
the
right.
hiring decisions.
That's right.
Did you have special training programs?
We did.
That what we were
we,
called at that time sensitivity training.
Training. We did some sensitivity training. We did a lot of hands-on with the profit center managers and with their key management team in terms of helping them develop strategies for getting
okay.
the job done.
Okay.
For an example, we set up the Dallas committee, the Chicago committee, in all of our major cities where we had multiple profit centers.
Uh-huh.
We began to bring all the heads of those companies mm-hmm. together for at least once a month strategy planning sessions mm-hmm. because we wanted Borden to have the right kind of image in that community as well. We wanted to do the right thing, but we also wanted the community to know that we were doing the right thing. So it really required a tremendous amount of hands-on activity with the managers of those companies. I met with them on a monthly basis, and we actually developed strategies and goals, and we got them competing in and among themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We actually got some of the MBA programs
mm-hmm.
at the local colleges and universities to begin working with us, and we would say, develop your plan in terms of what kind of managers you need over the course of the next year in your various divisions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we took that information, and then we would go to a Northwestern and a University of Chicago, and we would say to them, we're interested in beginning to hire some of your MBA, African American MBAs.
Mm-hmm.
And we're willing to hire them while they're still students at 10,
okay.
15 hours a week.
Tom, this is a model.
And pay proper dollars.
I'll tell you, there were other companies that were very creative too, but that what you've just described is a marvelous program. And you mentioned African Americans several times. The emphasis, I take it, was still on African Americans.
We didn't even begin to think about the Hispanic community.
Uh-huh.
it wasn't a factor.
Yeah, they haven't come on the scene yet.
It wasn't a factor.
Well, that right. It was even more so in the South. Did Borden have plants in the South?
We had some plants in the South.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. The vast majority of our plants were in the West, the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of chemical operations in Louisiana.
But you still had that deficiency of hiring minorities, in particular blacks, in all of those locations outside of the South.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. With very few exceptions.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay. Let's stop for just a minute. Okay, Tom, let's pick it up off the record here. I just went through a background on how the Private Industry Council, the CETA Private Industry Council, was put together and incorporated before the law was effective. And we just discussed that it's all a matter of record. But somehow you and I got together on getting a partnership between the Atlanta Chamber and the PICNAB group. The NAB Metro was established, and eventually the Private Industry Council took over all the functions of NAB. But we were in that transition period, so everything was tick now. Mm-hmm. And I have in my hand a possible presentation to the Atlanta Chamber Board, which I put together for you. And it's the rationale for the chamber being involved with the PICNAB. So let's just, without going into detail here, you had a good feeling about doing this.
I had a good feeling about doing it because I had talked very strongly to the search committee when I was hired by the Atlanta Chamber about my strong feeling about involvement of the minority community. And because we did have some operations in Georgia, I was somewhat familiar with the value and strength of the Atlanta community in relationship to minorities. Atlanta didn't have some of the problems other cities did because of the existence of the five major black colleges and universities.
Right.
And that the combination of that and the action form and the interface
right.
between the black and white community had a great deal to do with some stability.
Peace in Atlanta.
Exactly. And, you know, Maynard was in his first term.
Right.
We had a new city manager. We had a lot going for us, but we had a lot to overcome. The first day I was on the job at the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce, I was picketed by the black community.
That almost made you famous.
Well, I ended up on top of the car with Hosea Williams.
Okay.
And inviting him, and I said, you can't all come up to my office, but I would be more than happy to meet a delegation.
And what were they protesting?
They were protesting the need for jobs.
Okay.
The need for economic...
Not getting enough...
The need for economic development.
Okay.
The need for improvements in the education system.
Okay.
Okay. They were... It was the overall picture.
Yeah.
And Hosea, bless him, he said, well, hey, here comes this new kid on the block, you know, let's shake his tree.
Okay.
And he did a pretty good job of it. But I said, well, you know, I don't know what to do other than to get up on top of that car with him. So I did.
Is that before this recommendation?
This was 1974.
Oh, this is good. It was.
It was December of 1974.
Okay.
So one of the first things I did, and it was again a precursor, because I had been one of the founding members of the National Minority Supplier Development Council.
Right.
Along with Standard Oil of Indiana, Borden had been the primary sponsors of that group with the Department of Commerce.
Yeah.
So one of the first things I did in 1975 and into early 1976, working with the national, with the Black Chamber, the Atlanta Business League.
Yep.
In conjunction with the Atlanta Business League, the Atlanta Chamber mm-hmm. formed the Atlanta Area Minority Purchasing Council.
Yep.
So we were actively working for a couple of years in terms of trying to improve the relationship between business
mm-hmm.
and the black business community to create more jobs and more
mm-hmm.
funding going from major businesses to minority businesses
mm-hmm.
and from government contracts to minority businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think one of the ways we got together, Hugh, if my memory serves me correctly, is that Lockheed Marietta was one of the first companies to come and join our Minority Purchasing Council.
Okay.
Okay? If I'm not mistaken...
That makes sense, because that's the purchasing, that's the... I forget, there's another name of it, but the purchasing agents and all those
right.
in that organization, and they were active in the purchasing
council.
To get minority. Because we had a huge vending program.
Yes, you did.
There was a lot of money there. And they saw a need to do that.
Right, and it strikes me
that the
first five companies that came together to do that were Lockheed, Trust Company Bank.
Right.
Hardin Construction.
Okay.
Oh my, that's terrible. I'm losing. Leo Benatar.
Mead.
Mead. Mead packaging.
Mead packaging.
And
what's the fifth?
Whatever.
Anyway, okay, we got that.
We started that process in 1975 and into early 1976.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a, pardon my French, a hell of a time,
mm-hmm,
getting the basis for its operation up and running.
Mm-hmm.
But we finally came to agreement and actually talked with the King Center and got Daddy King to come and to talk to our group as
right.
well. So at any rate, that was up and running, and I'm quite sure it was through that relationship with Lockheed
that you contacted me.
That, yes.
Or how we got together.
However, I can't forget that. And also the guy from Trust Company. Oh my.
Well, now Brad Curry was early.
Right, but this was Brad assigned it.
No, there was another guy that I dealt with there.
Billy Stern.
Well, he was the CEO.
Yeah, but who was the guy? He was a football player at Georgia Tech, and he became. Oh my goodness.
Okay, let's.
Isn't that terrible?
That's okay.
Well, at any rate, he also served with us on the pick.
Mm-hmm.
He was the Trust Company representative. To the pick.
That's probably in this book here. So.
Probably is. Well, at any rate, that's how, I'm quite sure that's how we came together, because it just made such good logical sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, there was at that time, we had several different private sector groups that were trying to get into the act of
right.
being progressive and things. That became a concern. We needed an umbrella organization. That's how we ended up with the PIC logo, PICNAB logo,
right.
under umbrella. There's too many demands on the business to come join us over here and over there. Come join us, you know, and that sort of thing.
Well, at any rate, that's how we came together.
Okay, let's pick it up right there at the point that I put together a document. I think you told me, you said, well, we can get the something to this effect. We can get the chamber involved in this thing. We have a task force on full employment already.
Right.
And Wilson, I can't think of his name. There were several guys involved. Well, Larry Gellerstedt was involved,
mm-hmm.
surely.
Yeah, he was.
But you wanted more involvement, and we wanted to put it all together. We just didn't want all of these. The companies didn't say, I don't want to join these five organizations. Can't we just deal with one organization?
You know? Precisely.
And that makes a lot of sense.
And so we felt, well, we can do that.
The answer is to just get the chamber involved, and that gets them all involved. So you asked me to put together something that you could take to the executive committee.
Right.
And I did. Is that somebody you want to?
Yeah, Wade Mitchell.
Oh, Wade Mitchell.
Right. Was
okay.
The fellow from Trust Company.
Right.
Wade had been working with us on the Minority Purchasing
yeah.
Council as well.
Okay. Wade replaced me as the regional exec. National Alliance of Business, and they sort of booted him. Andrew Jackson came up with it, said we want all of the members of the PIC that we work with to be residents of the city of Atlanta, and I wasn't.
Ah.
So they wrote me a letter and said, thanks a lot for all you've done, and Wade Mitchell was the successor because he lived in the city.
Okay.
And I have done it. I've got a taped interview with Wade.
Good.
Going all of that.
Good.
So anyway, you went to the executive committee. Now, could you remember what their reaction? Not interested in detail, but generally, they must have said must be a good idea.
Well, they said it's a good idea. Certainly, if we can get some coordination among the existing organizations, you're already pushing us on minority purchasing,
mm-hmm.
And that's the other arm on the same body.
Right.
So let's do it. But we're really concerned about this overlay of additional activity with a limited staff. Because you may or may not remember that when I inherited the chamber in 74, I had 62 people on the staff, and the economy had gone to pot because of the first major exposure to the problem of the oil shakes changing the price of the barrel. And we had millions of square feet of vacant space in Atlanta, and I had, one of the first things I had to do was cut staff. So there was real concern over taking on the responsibility if we didn't have some way to staff it. And so you probably remember the details on this.
I'm trying to find them right now as you're reaching. We did come up with some budget.
We did come up with a budget.
Uh-huh.
And we came up with some mechanisms for raising the money necessary to hire an executive. Isn't that where we brought John Gilman into?
That's where you brought, it was Archie Lavelle.
First,
and then John.
And then John Gilman.
And Archie was a black person.
Right. But the Chamber Executive Committee said, okay, we will buy in, but you've got to find a way to staff it. Because your current staff is stressed to the limit, because we had cut staff so significantly because of the economic downturn in 74 and 75. And okay, we were in the process of starting to rebuild, but we weren't there yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's the letter from Aaron Turpo to Jim Wilkerson, general manager, mm-hmm, of the chamber, in which they deal with the money thing. And they said that the city has $25,000 under the new, mm-hmm, PSIP contract. And all right, there we go. I think we're back on record again. We're talking about the original funding of the contract.
And that was what? That was
$15,005.
And that was in 1978, was it?
This is in 19... Yes, that's July of 1978.
July of 78.
78.
Okay, and so with that funding, we put some money in our budget. We also got some money from a couple of the companies, if I'm not mistaken. We had formed a foundation at the chamber so that we could accept contributions for various programs, yeah, mm-hmm, without interfering with the basic operational, right, budget of the chamber.
Mm-hmm. And we had to have a contract.
And
the PIC executive director was a salary of $20,001.
Right.
And
then, of course, it took, that executive had to also then get the benefits. We had to have an insurance plan and what have you.
The secretary was $9,600.
Right.
Once you got approval, then we moved the PICNAB offices right into the 13th floor.
Right into our new offices over in the Omni Center.
All right.
And we said, look, if we're going to really kick this thing off with a gong, we really need to get some good press exposure.
Right.
And we needed to do that not only through the Chamber's publications, both Atlanta Magazine and the Forward Atlanta Newsletter.
Right.
But we needed to get the Journal Constitution and the other neighborhood newspapers and a variety of other publications on board. So in September of that year, we were ready to really launch.
That was the press backgrounder.
We did a press backgrounder.
That you have in your hand.
Right, and we invited broadly press from throughout the Southeast. We invited, in addition to that, because my press guy at that point was by the name of Brennan. He had been in charge of CBS News for the southeastern United States. And so he invited CBS, ABC, NBC, a wide variety of media types to come and participate. And we had Leo Benatar, who was our, mm-hmm, chairman of the board of the Private Industry Council and chairman of the board of Metro Atlanta National Alliance of Business, as a part of that team. We had John Armour, who was National Vice President of the National Alliance of Business, and Dorothy First, training manager, Peachtree Plaza Hotel, and Art Cummings, the chief administrative officer of Atlanta, as a panel. And we really laid out for the media on that occasion all of the goals and the objectives.
Well, you know, just looking at it from my standpoint, sitting there, I think when we incorporated, I made myself president.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that I would have to be active, and I just wanted to have some voice in there instead of being just the guy that started it.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked out real good. And I was just overwhelmed at, I don't know if that's the word or not, but it was a godsend to have all the expertise of communications and promotion of the Atlanta Chamber, everything that you've got in your hand in that press background. And I've reread it recently, and it's very impressive because it shows the mentality of the private sector. Once the private sector gets involved in something, the ingenuity and creativity and the thoroughness and the professionalism is epitomized in the chamber.
Right.
How many members? You had about 5,000 members.
At that point, we were just coming out of our recession period, the 1974-75, we took a nosedive.
Uh-huh.
We were down to about 3,000.
Yeah.
And I guess by 78, we were probably back up to about 5,000.
Yeah, that was my recollection.
Mm-hmm. I think that was right.
And just think, all the communications went out to all of these mid and small size companies, as well as the biggies.
The biggies. Large, small, from the individual entrepreneur to the major banks.
And that's 80% of all the jobs. It really just leapfrogged all over these hurdles.
And what we did too is we had divided the chamber down into six or seven area councils because when I came to the chamber, all the outlying areas were saying all the chamber thinks about is downtown. And so what we did is we set up the seven sub-chamber groups, so every community. Cobb had a group, each of the counties. DeKalb had a group, Gwinnett had a group.
Let me tell you how it came in when I incorporated the PIC. I went to Bob Barton, our labor lawyer, and said, I need you to help me with incorporating this new entity, Private Industry Council of Atlanta, Inc. And he said, well, Hugh, I'm going to give you the code book, and you put all of the stuff in there about the board of directors and offices and everything, and I will do the finish job and get it incorporated. So you and I talked about who was going to be on that board, and
mm-hmm.
this was a little stroke of genius or something, but it was those five area councils were on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And that immediately got people
like, outreach.
You got Blaine Kelly.
Right.
And Blaine went on. That was his introduction to all of this promotional
stuff.
And
it was a revelation to him, and he really bought in.
He did, and he went on to become the regional director of mm-hmm. the National Alliance of Business,
right.
I believe it was.
Right.
And he was, and that was a lot of support. He was a very capable guy. And I have in the hand right here on February the 27th of 79, this was a board of directors meeting in which we had a luncheon. And Mel Davis was executive director of Opportunities Industrialization, and we had these black guys, Lyndon Wade, executive director of Urban League, Levi Moore, Economic Opportunity, and Al Mottelbaugh was named vice president of the board. John Cox became a member.
From Delta, yeah.
We were really moving along, and I have copies of all of the board of directors' meetings, and it shows the activity and the involvement, creativity of the private sector.
To help build up to that point too, you may remember, Hugh, back in March or April, I guess April, May of 78,
uh-huh.
we put together a loan executive program.
Oh yes.
The purpose of that was to help us gather all of the data we needed in order to be able to really move forward with our program. We needed to have some baseline. We needed to really know where the community and the surrounding communities stood in relationship to minority hiring and firing and what have you. So we did a business survey with some 3,600 members of the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce to determine their needs and requirements.
Oh, that was great.
And we did a training survey with over 50 questionnaires mailed to area training agencies to determine from them what they saw as the strengths and the weaknesses and the needs. So we needed that kind of a base in order to be able to really plan for the future and to be able to say, where are we now and where are we going and are we making progress? And that was the whole purpose of that task force.
Well, that's fantastic. Again, there's so many examples of the creativity and the professionalism of the private sector mentality. And what I say in several places, it's appropriate to say this, that when you turn loose American business with a task, and they treat it as though they're making profit for their own company, with all of the creativity and ingenuity that's characteristic of American business.
Well, you know, I could well remember the executive committee saying, okay, Hamill, we're going to be out in front of God and everybody. and if, you know, and this has got to work.
Well, those account executives that studied the situation and came up with basically the need to be involved was great. Let me stop for a minute here. The private sector initiative program was something that changed the whole ball game of money for these prime sponsors. They had sole control what to do with it. And they fought it in Congress and lost. The momentum was there, the CETA was outlived itself, and so now the private sector came in, and I'm probably repeating myself, but the chairman of the private industry council had to be from the private sector, and 50% or more than 51% of the members had to be from the private sector. And but it was still under CETA. We had to work with the city because the money came through the city to us, and they had some leverage, even though that we had the role, a good role picked out for us that was much needed, private sector jobs. So Aaron Turpo was a representative from Ada Jackson, and he said that we're going to have to prove ourselves, and that we're going to have to lay off some people. It's about 600 people we're going to have to be laid off, and we're asking you to find jobs for those 600 people. Well, first of all, that's in my mind, that's a very unfortunate way to bring the private sector
into the
picture, because they're going to look at people to consider to hire that didn't have the work ethic that you have in the public sector, and the ethic that they needed in the private sector, and plus they had no skills, no functional skills that are needed. So. But we agreed because we didn't have much choice.
Right.
We said, okay, we'll do it. So we went out, and bottom line here, I've got the statistics at home. We produced more jobs than they had candidates to take the job. And that we accomplished what we wanted to do. But some of these people didn't even go for interviews. I got all the records on this. We'd get interviews for them, didn't go on interviews. They had a warm bed and they didn't want to leave it, and they kept thinking that maybe something
they could wait it out and
they could wait it out.
Job.
I'm sure that was in the minds of a lot of them.
Many of them.
And some of them told us that we could stay here. We're better off here in the government. Or a lot of them were doing jobs like the Urban League, Goodwill Industries, and much needed services, but didn't prepare them to go into the private sector. We got over that, sir, and then we started, as you mentioned here, on promotion in the private sector. The private sector took over. The seat of Leo Belknap, I was the first chairman. But eventually, the private sector initiative program proved itself nationally to be the way that the government ought to go with its employment and training job programs. And incidentally, Congress for many, many years has passed every year employment and training legislation. The Manpower Training Development Act, and just, I can't remember them right now, but I've got a list of them. And they just felt an obligation to help solve this problem of hardcore unemployment, disadvantaged people, blacks not getting a fair share or being qualified and all that sort of thing. So the PSIP program became the predecessor to the Job Training Partnership Act. And in the refunding process, CETA was not renewed, and the next legislation of Congress was the Job Training Partnership Act. Okay, that what that meant to Atlanta is we now have a new law, and the board of directors of the old law and the chairman are out. And so I think, I'm not sure, I think Andy Young might have been mayor of Atlanta at that time.
Time, yes.
And we had to get a chairman. And so I was on the, the committee to recommend a chairman.
Search committee.
Mm-hmm. And turns out I had nothing to do with it. And the Young decided it would be John Clendenin. Of course,
it wasn't a bad choice.
It was a superb choice, and I didn't have the power to do that. And he got the best man available for it.
He really did.
That we began to work together with the city. At
yes.
that point, that's we really sort of bonded, and when I'll never forget the first board meeting with Clendenin. It was in your conference room, and he was sitting down to the far end, to where I was sitting, the left end, and we had several community people there, and they wanted to talk about all. I don't know whether you attended that meeting or not. Do you remember that meeting?
Oh, yes.
I thought you would be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was our first meeting. And they wanted to talk about what was wrong.
Always.
The community to be.
Right.
And all, there were two women. And I could see the look on John Clendenin's face. And he just didn't want to turn them off. He wanted to be receptive.
Mm-hmm.
He listened to everybody. He
right.
was fair. So I spoke up and I said, can't we get back to some of these issues that we're supposed to be dealing with? I think if he could have gotten up and shaken my hand, I think he would have. But that turned it around, and then we got into the real business of what was going on. But that's part of the transition that we had to deal with.
A very important part of the transition.
Uh-huh.
And what we had to constantly try to remember is that there were a lot of people out there who had nothing but frustration, who we had not been able to communicate with properly, we had never really been able to reach. And when we brought in someone of the caliber and the quality of a John Clendenin, they saw this in their frustration as a real opportunity to perhaps be heard, because they knew that he had personally and corporately established some policies that made it possible for the minority community to begin to see some light at the end of the tunnel, those
right.
who were at the very bottom of the
yeah.
bottom of the totem pole. So it was a good cathartic. It was something that had to be done, but it was something that we had to live with through every aspect of this. You know, back, as I think I mentioned to you earlier, my very first day on the job at the chamber, I was picketed by the black community. And why did they do that then? Because they realized that the chamber had the power to do some things, but it hadn't done it. And here's this new kid on the block, so let's rattle his cage and maybe he will do something. So it was in part out of desperation.
Yeah.
And I think the Clendenin situation was just a continuation of that by some other people who had not been reached.
we can look back on it. This was a turning point. One of my book working titles is Breakthrough, Race and the Workplace. And another one is Crossing the Color Line with the Integration Generation. Another term that I've coined is the Affirmative Action Movement. It all started right here in Atlanta with Bobby Troutman and Joe Cruz and Plans for Progress thing. And that's all.
And a lot of that really came out of discussions that occurred much, much earlier in the Action Forum.
Right.
You know, if it had not been for the Action Forum,
right,
and about a dozen of the top white leaders in the community meeting with a like number of black leaders,
right,
and meeting once a month at the, what was it, the restaurant, the Danish restaurant that was something son. Oh my.
I'm trying to think of it too.
At Peachtree Center.
Okay.
Okay. And John Portman owned a restaurant.
Okay.
And he made the back room available on us one Saturday morning a month. And those 24
uh-huh.
came together.
Right.
And I was invited to be a staff backup because mm-hmm. Dan Sweat, God bless him. The two of us were there
mm-hmm.
so that we knew what the leadership was mm-hmm. talking about,
mm-hmm.
and then we could commiserate and make some decisions in terms of, okay, how at the staff level could Central Atlanta Progress mm-hmm. and the Atlanta Chamber, we were competitive on one hand and yet collaborative on the other. So how could we not step on each other's toes and try to get on with some of the issues that these fellows were bringing up? But those 24 people getting together once a month and with follow-up being accomplished,
yeah,
really kept the lid on the race situation in Atlanta.
It did from a political point of view. It, the restlessness was still there.
Oh yes, it was still there. But it kept the lid on.
It kept the lid on it, and it served a very useful purpose. There was a meeting in August of 66 in which Whitney Young came, I mentioned this on the phone, I believe, came to Atlanta. He volunteered, he called J. Paul Austin, Coca-Cola, and said, if you can put together the movers and shakers and put it in a private room, no press, closed doors, I'll come down and talk to him about, basically, to not be too complacent, that the riots going on elsewhere around the country, and despite the goodwill that you have politically, that restlessness could happen in Atlanta too. So this is sort of interesting. Paul Austin had a letter to send out to all the CEOs at the movers and shakers, and these were the CEOs, not their representatives. And he asked me to co-sign the invitation letter. This is the tenure of the Times.
Mm-hmm.
He knew the pulse of these top executives.
Right.
He knew that just to invite them to hear a black man talk is may not get the turnout that it otherwise would. That's my supposition, but it looks like when you put it all together,
he was also delivering a message that there was an organizational
yeah.
structure in place to deal with
it
some of these
was.
Issues, and this is the guy
that's
who
right.
carries
and
that
we
will, responsibility.
One of my theories is that we move together.
Right, Paul was
instead
a very, very deliberate,
uh-huh.
very deliberate man.
And so I signed it. I just started the Atlanta American Football Association. In March, I mean, three few months over. And Charles Adams, one of the senior vice presidents of Coca-Cola, was on my Atlanta American Football Association board. I started off with top people all the way around.
Sure.
I mean, I really had all the senior vice presidents, Richard Horsey from Coca-Cola Company, who went out front for Coca-Cola in the community. He was part of the family. Charles had asked Paul Austin. That's how I got to co-sign. And it did, like you say, it credibility. We are moving. We got some things going on here, association of business people.
And terribly important in the Atlanta community. It always had been. I'm not sure that it is as important today because this is no longer a community of leaders. It's a community of managers, if you right. don't mind my saying that. But I think that's really the case.
Yeah.
But it was terribly important back in the 60s and 70s and even into the early 80s that there were some standard bearers. And you'd better have at least one or two of those top standard bearers behind you
right.
or you weren't going to get off the ground.
Yeah, that makes sense. Other little wrinkle here. Paul Austin, Southern Bell had just created the chair of private enterprise at what's now the Georgia State College. It was Georgia State College, I guess it was. And so the Vice President Thompson, part of this invitation, and asked Mike Mescon mm-hmm. to be a co-speaker. So we had a black speaker and a white speaker. Paul Austin engineered that.
Sure.
He got them to do that. And so we had the white speaker and the black speaker.
Paul was always a very, very thorough thinker. You know, he never opened his mouth without something really very specific and uh-huh. concrete to say.
Yeah.
And it's something that you had to learn, but it was very important to learn it. He never spoke unless he had something worthwhile to say.
You know, one of the cherished items in my collection is a 6-inch tape of that meeting. And incidentally, I was the MC, and Richie Horsey did the introduction to both Mike Mescon and Whitney Young. And Whitney Young gave a very inspired talk, and I've converted that to cassette, and now I have a transcript for that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
It is priceless. Whitney Young is pretty well known. He was the only civil rights leader that really related to business. The rest of them were adversaries. And but he was out front. He got a lot of business funding, and totally different from all of the other civil rights leaders. He had his way of getting cooperation. And in this particular speech presentation, he mixed in humor, and it was wonderful. He kept everybody just tuned to what he was saying, and they got the message, do not be complacent, do something. And one of the members, two of the people that were there, and I forget their names now, they're deceased, told me that that meeting did a lot to support the Atlanta Marine Employment Association in following years. The businesses cooperated, and our membership went up, and participation in our youth motivation program, which still exists today, was supported by all these companies. And the impetus a lot of them attribute to was Whitney Young's speech.
Out of the activities that we are talking about, a lot of things happened subsequently that I think have really played a major role in some stabilization. We still have a long way to go. Atlanta
right.
still isn't the city that it needs
we
to be.
We always will.
But the fact of the matter is that we began to realize that if we were really going to deal with a long-term issue of employment, that we needed to deal with education. And as a result of that, the Chamber established its partnership in education. And we had over 280 companies that were dealing on a one-on-one basis with schools within the Atlantic Public School system. And we began doing summer programs, you may remember, for teachers, where we actually took teachers from the Atlanta Public Schools and put them into summertime jobs for the 6 to 8 weeks over the summer.
We did that in the American Plumbing
right.
Association.
Right. We had them at entry-level jobs in industry and paid them extremely well to do it. But at the end of the summer, we brought them back together, and they would say, we had no idea what it took to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, are we going to be able to tell our kids now to a much greater degree what they need to know and how they need to operate once they get out into the world of work. But that would not have come about if it weren't for the work that we were already doing through the PIC and through the Minority Purchasing Council. It was a natural outgrowth of that activity.
The kickoff with the first partnership with Atlanta Public School Education and the private sector of any real significance on dealing with race was in 1965. Plans for Progress in Washington, and we had a lone staff of 5 business executives, were getting feedback from companies that were signing Plans for Progress, changing their policies and recruiting and saying, we've got a problem with the lack of education with these applicants that come into us, and between education and motivation, big time. And so Plans for Progress was going to move beyond signing up companies' Plans for Progress, but to education. And so we had a pilot program. They had a private program at Wayne State University in 64.
Mm-hmm.
It was a vocational guidance counseling.
Mm-hmm.
It was then we picked up on it in 65 and started that in 65. And we hired these two professors at Georgia State College to administer the program, and we paid them and a stipend. And we paid the vocational guidance counselors who came to the seminar, 2-week seminar, we paid them a stipend to come.
To come, exactly. No, unfortunately, those are the kinds of things
and
we needed to do.
We did 6 of those. It was so successful.
Right.
We were bonding, and I have all the files on that.
Mm-hmm.
I have the working files. It was a person named Louis Van Gorder in Southeast Atlanta, and I called on him and if he had any records of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, in a box in my garage, it's sort of dusty. And I went over there and got his records. And one of the most cherished parts of my collection is this historic breakthrough in the South of black and white business dealing with the educational deficiencies that need to be addressed.
So much still needs to be done. I'm happy to say that the Partners in Education program at the Chamber is still going, how active it is and what results they're getting. I haven't really kept up with it. But the fact is that until we actually get business working in collaboration with school systems, the opportunity for long-term growth and development don't exist. The fact is that one of our major problems in the Atlanta public schools in particular, through the 60s and the 70s and into the early 80s, I can speak of on a personal level, is that most of the teachers, not all, but a vast majority of the teachers in the Atlanta public schools did not believe that their kids could learn. That is the tragedy of public education in Atlanta.
I think that came out in the Kerner Commission report too.
It did. But the real problem today is that we cannot train teachers well enough and fast enough to be able to fill the gaps primarily in mathematics and science, which are the areas that industry really requires. And until we really address that issue by changing the way we train teachers, there's too much emphasis on methods courses and not enough content. We don't teach enough math and science for them to be good teachers of math and science. But that's another issue.
I don't think this issue of helping blacks in large numbers in the low-income areas into the private sector jobs is always going to be a huge challenge.
Yes.
There've been many articles and a lot written about this. It's housing, it's transportation, and it's still a problem, and motivation. The program which we started in 66 called the let me go back to this meeting. Do you think, I just wonder if there's anybody who attended the August meeting at the Dinkler Plaza Ballroom Any of those people are still around?
The Dinkler Plaza meeting was before my time.
This was 66.
Yeah, that was before my time. You would have to...
I don't have a roster who attended.
Well, if you had a roster, I wonder what might exist. Was the chamber involved in that meeting?
No.
Okay. No. What about the Ivan Allen Research Library at the downtown library? They might, it's a possibility, they might have some material on the shelf that would be helpful to you in that regard.
That would be great. Coca-Cola could too, but if I could talk to the historian, I haven't been able to get their attention yet.
Mm-hmm.
But then Paul Eston must have had a list of the people
sure.
invited.
I'm sure he did.
Let me skip on, though, to something else. I get things. There we go. Tom, let's talk about how the selection was made for Jesse Hill and Herman Russell to be head of the chamber. We call it chairman, president.
Back in those days, it was president.
Okay.
Today, it's chairman.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. Well, if you would, why don't you tell me the process and the reaction?
Okay. One has to recognize that to become president of the Atlanta Chamber back in the 60s and 70s, the process was a little different than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
One had to be an understudy for a significant number of years.
Mm-hmm.
An individual who was felt to have the potential to become the president of the chamber came into the executive committee and served 1 year as a member of the executive committee, just without any specific responsibility. The next year served as secretary and carried responsibility
mm-hmm.
for interface with a certain number of the task forces of the chamber and
mm-hmm.
committees. The next year they would become treasurer and would obviously have an interface with the membership
yeah.
operations.
They were groomed.
The following year they would be a vice president. They would be working with the economic development activities and the airline route group. The following year, they would be the president-elect.
Mm-hmm.
And the next year, president.
Mm-hmm.
And the following year, immediate past president. So
mm-hmm.
a commitment to become president of the chamber required 5 years before you made the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
Sixth year you were the president, and the seventh year you were there to be of support to the new president.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a long and a very arduous but very important process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a result of that, we had a group of really top quality leaders. That's
right.
Not saying that there aren't good quality leaders today, because I think they've had some remarkable people.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the system that was established at that point. When I was hired in 74, a couple of years before Jesse was due to move up the ladder, he was in the executive committee and he was in the chairs. And I really think, although it was never said to me in specific words by either Brad Curry or by Ivan Allen III, they're the two that were primarily responsible for hiring me, that one of the reasons I was brought in was because of the relationship that I had been able to develop in working with the black community in Newark
mm-hmm.
after the riots. But I think that had certainly something to do with my selection, because
mm-hmm.
I was not a newcomer to working with
mm-hmm.
black leadership. But it was a tough transition. It was hard for many members of the chamber to accept the idea of a black president. Jesse Hill and Herm Russell were both extraordinary men, as different as night and day.
Mm-hmm.
We always used to joke about Jesse, who was very hyperactive, always involved in too many things, that he was the only man we knew who could attend three breakfast meetings by arriving at each one late and leaving early.
That's a good one.
But he was scattershot. He would come up with new ideas. He would surprise you as the executive by always coming up with a new task force, whether you needed it or not. And sometimes his vision was so great. I mean, you know, he had us working on environment with Tom Stelson from Georgia Tech, the head of research at Georgia Tech, way before anybody else was even thinking about it. And everybody thought, my God in heaven, what is this guy doing? You know, but his idea was solid. You know, he had thought it through personally very carefully. Problem is, he never shared it with the other members of the executive committee. Uh-huh. So it caused some interesting moments. But he turned out to be, I think, a very successful president. Mm-hmm. It was a tough year for me, but it was a very successful year for the chamber.
The race issue was still there.
It was still very much there. Then Herm Russell.
Did you see a conversion of people?
I think we began to see, there were a lot of people saying, well, he shoots from the hip, and he did. But nonetheless, they saw that the wheels didn't come off the wagon. You know, that the other members of the executive committee were there and were solid and supportive, and the program moved forward, and that Jesse accomplished a number of specific goals during his year as president. Then Herm came along, and Herman, of the 10 chamber presidents that I served, I probably had the closest and the most rewarding and wonderful relationship with Herman Russell of any of the 10. A warm, caring, sensitive man who really could work wonderfully well across the color line. He had more ability in that regard because of his intense humanity and his goodwill that could never, ever be doubted for one moment.
Do you want to take a guess at what years they served? There must have been a space of time before Herman was put in.
I came in 75. It was either 70, 77 or 70, it was 78.
For Herman.
No, it was 78
for
Jesse. And 80 or 81 for Herman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they were, you know, by the time Herman was there, everybody was comfortable with the idea.
Okay, the race issue wasn't as critical.
The race issue wasn't.
You know,
even,
that gets back to what.
Was it a matter of any concern?
Hi. Mm-hmm.
This goes back to what I spoke about, the bonding that occurs in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same principle.
Right. It was very matter of fact when Herm came in.
The people that were concerned and had a racial attitude about Jesse, they somewhat bonded with the idea of blacks being capable to do the job.
Right. Another thing that I think helped immensely was, it was either 76 or 77, and we had been doing quite a little bit of work with the black community at that point, and AFSCME went on strike on the city, and all of the garbage drivers, all the garbage workers, and they were really creating havoc for us.
Mm-hmm.
The garbage isn't picked up, what have you. And we were really getting desperate. How do we break this? You know, we want to deal with the issue, but we can't continue to just negotiate forever. We need to get these people back on the job. Well, with permission, I went to visit with Daddy King.
Okay.
And Daddy King agreed, after some time, that he would come and participate in a press conference at the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce, and that he would get up and tell the garbage workers, get back on the job. We need to negotiate. You need to be treated fairly. But the city can't tolerate this.
Okay.
Get back on the job.
Wonderful.
And I really think that went a long, long way towards the white community and the white business community really opening up more to the black community when one of their key loved leaders was willing to take a very brave, a very bold
Sure.
And very courageous stand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's pause for a minute. There you go.
Workplace integration will continue to be a problem until we have really resolved the issue of proper education at the K-12 level. Without a 12th grade education, it becomes increasingly difficult, if not impossible, for anyone to have a job that's going to pay a wage that will allow them to live decently. Increasingly beyond that, a two-year technical education or a four-year college education is going to become increasingly more critical. The real problem is not the ability of the minority community to learn. The real difficulty is to create the environment in which they can learn. They have the capacity. In the work that I did after leaving the chamber with Georgia Tech during my 13 years there, I headed a department called University Partnerships, and our outreach was to the African-American community through K-12 education in mathematics and science. Those kids are just as bright, just as able as any white kid to do the work if they're given the opportunity to do it correctly. We need to deal with the colleges of education, to change the way that they teach, the curriculum that they give, to put more emphasis on content and less on method, and we need to change this class size within our school system so that we are able to really focus the time and attention. Until we do this, we're going to continue to have a massive difference between the education of our white students and the education of our minority students. When in some school systems, 60%, 70%, or more of the kids are on free breakfasts and free lunches, it says an awful lot about the level of poverty that exists in their households. And we're not going to break that cycle until we're able to motivate and educate kids properly to be able to go out into the world of work and get jobs that are decent. When mothers are 15 and 16 and grandmothers are 38, 39, and 40, the grandmothers are the future of our black community at this point if education doesn't get off their duff and start training teachers properly. The business community can't do it all. Families have got to do it. School teachers can do a lot of back and fill if they're given the right tools. We're not giving teachers the correct tools, and we're not motivating them correctly through proper salary.
Thank you. Tom, thank you very much.